Hello everyone, this is Mike Quinsey connecting the light. My guest today is Philip Mantle. He is the editor of UFO Matrix magazine, which was launched in the US in August this year. And he obviously wants to talk about that, but in particular his new book called Alien Autopsy Casebook. So welcome to the program, Philip.
Good evening.
Would I be correct in assuming that you launched the magazine firstly in the UK, or was it a double launch?
That's correct. I mean, it was first launched in the United Kingdom.
Yes.
That was the 30th of September.
All right.
And even though we had it ready for the worldwide, it goes in many different countries, mainly in the United States. For whatever reason, dealing with distributors, it comes out about a month after. So, you know, it's a bi-monthly publication, so once it's out here, about 4 weeks later, it's available in the US and various other places dotted around the world. And we're currently at issue number two, so and the second
right.
will be out in America at the end of this month. So we're very pleased with that.
Yes, indeed. I should tell our guests that you are an ex-director of BUFORA, which is the British UFO Research Association, that has a very long history of many years. I can remember subscribing to that. I think must have been about 40 years or so. So that had been around a long time. And if I may say, and it's probably relative to the period that it was very popular in, it was probably a little bit more of a nuts and bolts type magazine, which tended to take a more scientific view. But of course, everybody's got used to UFOs and ETs and contacts, so I think something like your UFO Matrix magazine, of course, it is totally different, I guess. Would you like to tell us a little bit about the format of it?
Absolutely. I mean, the magazine is a broad church, pretty much like the UFO subject itself. So we do try and cover just about anything within the within its pages. Each issue has a loose theme. For example, you know, issue one, we looked at Roswell for a kickoff, but only, you know, three or four articles about that, which is not a lot when it's a 100-page magazine. In issue two, for example, we've concentrated on the different aspects of the abduction phenomenon. But again,
yes,
it's just one part of the whole magazine. And so there will be a loose theme running it. Issue three, for example, we're going to look at Rendlesham, because it's the 30th anniversary in December of the Rendlesham events, and
oh, yeah,
so on. But quite literally, we cover just about anything and everything. And a nice blend and a nice mix. Hopefully, there's something there for everybody.
I'm sure there must be, yes. You said one of your objects, obviously, in bringing out the magazine was to keep the UFO subject in the public eye. And I couldn't help thinking to myself that with the number of developments over the last month or so, and some very positive speculation about disclosure coming up perhaps very soon, it couldn't be perhaps more appropriate. Because I think following the death of Graham Birdsall, the editor of UFO magazine, there's really been an empty spot there that you appear to have filled.
Well, yes, I cut my teeth in ufology with Graham Birdsall, you know, knew him for many, many years, and he is sadly missed. And UFO magazine, of which he was, you know, owner, publisher and editor, you know, died when sadly Graham died, you know, completely out of the blue all of a sudden. And so we've tried to fill that gap, although we've not tried to replicate UFO magazine in any way at all. And we were quite lucky in that respect that when the first issue of UFO Matrix came out, it coincided with the latest release of the Ministry of Defence UFO files in the UK. And like you've just mentioned, since then there's been, you know, a lot of press and publicity about books, about disclosure, about meetings and conferences, and the recent ones are about the alleged UFO sightings over nuclear missile sites in the United States at the press club in America. So, you know, we've been lucky in that respect. It's kind of publicity we couldn't have paid for. But as far as magazines were concerned, there wasn't one that you could go and buy in your high street. You know, it's in the UK, you can buy it in W.H. Smith's, and overseas, yes, it's, you know, Borders and Barnes and Noble and that kind of thing. Mm. So, you know, we've been very lucky in that respect. So hopefully we will fill that gap that UFO magazine left. But we're not trying to replicate anything in that respect.
No. Well, I think the way things are likely to develop, I think you're going to have plenty of material for your future magazines. I noticed in the one that I saw the front cover of, which I may say is very attractive, very good design, you also have some of the, evidently, some of the MOD files in there that were released by Nick Pope.
That's right. I mean, in issue one, like I said, we did an overview of the previous files that had been released to coincide with the ones that were currently being released. You know, we're not allowed to have access to anything in advance. The issue that you're referring to, I believe, was probably issue number one. Cover design was done by an artist, graphic artist here in the UK by the name of David Sankey. David was and still is part of Beaufort, as far as I'm aware. So we're quite fortunate that, you know, David's design kind of fitted with what we had in mind for the first issue. It's not just Nick Pope that writes, but we've got a number of columnists from around the world. We try to have a nice mix of some that perhaps you will recognize, like Nick, but others that you probably never heard of before. And again, hopefully we'll keep the magazine fresh. We've got a lot of material that's either never been published before, or has only been published in you know, sort of little local UFO group magazines and that kind of thing, not being viewed by a big audience. And again, it's just to further emphasize the diverse nature of the UFO subject. And so far, so good, I hope.
Yes, indeed. Well, one that did intrigue me, I mean, I'm only referring to the title on your front cover. I think it read as a day trip to Area 51. Now, are you talking about a recent day trip or one in the time that Area 51 was really active? Because am I not correct in thinking that a lot of what used to go on at Area 51 was transferred to another base?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's. I mean, the person that wrote it, John Wickham, this has gone in issue two, he didn't get inside the base. John did was a tour around the area and getting as near to the base as you could, visiting a lot of the local landmarks, like the mailbox there. He went to the little alien and things like that. I think he was out at the conference in Laughlin in Nevada at the same time. So he did a bit of everything while I was there. So it was a bit of an overview of the area and what you can and can't see anymore, because, you know, a lot of the land in the early days where you could get up and see things in the distance, now you can't get anywhere near it. So but it's a recent trip, it's not one that was done a long time ago. But again, one of the reasons for running the article is to, you know, Area 51 seems to have died off a little bit, certainly the interest in it anyway. So it's to add to the mixture, put that back into the into the frame and see what happens. And it's a very interesting article that John provided us for. And of course, John is now the chairman of Beaufort, so we're delighted to have that in the magazine.
Yes, well, I'm sure that's a subject that has a lot of mileage in it. Area 51 has been that mysterious place of many UFO sightings for a long number of years. Now, just one sort of final question about the mag, and that. Do you have to ever submit articles to any other authority before you can issue them?
Not at all, no. I mean, the only authority I have to run it by is my boss.
right.
But no, I mean, you know, like I say, we've got regular columnists who write things for every issue, and then we've got submissions quite literally from around the world, and we've got an awful lot of material. There's never no shortage of it at all on a wide range of subjects. And you know, I've been involved in ufology for a long time now, and, you know, I've read a lot about it, and it still amazes me of, you know, some of the material we get, really obscure but absolutely fascinating, and you know, we welcome more of it.
Yes. Now, you'll obviously know the facts about this, but I was always under the impression that where the press is concerned, that there is a certain element of censorship. For example, some years back, I understood that they were told that they shouldn't refer to triangular-shaped UFOs. Now, are you subject to any censorship like that?
Not at all. I mean, you know, we're privately funded. It's a small publishing company, Healings of Atlantis, that publishes the magazine, and run by a gentleman by the name of David Franklin. He's our boss. And Dave's extremely passionate about the subject, and the magazine came about quite by chance. It just came up in conversation, and, you know, it went from there. And the same company publishes our books as well. And it's their first venture into the magazine publishing, but there's no censorship. And like I say, you know, we have a small team. There's myself, there's the boss, Dave. My assistant editor is another well-known researcher by the name of Malcolm Robinson. You know, I have the final say, being the editor, what goes on, but we circulate material between us. And there's no censorship, but we check just to make everything's accurate and as best we can. And there's nothing slanderous or anything like that in there, because ufologists can sometimes have a bit of an argument between each other. And so far, so good. And, you know, long may it last. We'll keep our fingers crossed.
Absolutely, yes. Well, wish you every success with that. Now, we can start on your book, Alien Autopsy Casebook, which you say covers the full facts which are finally revealed. Now, what made you get involved in that in the first place? Because I'll tell our listeners that you said that it took you some 14 years to research and determine exactly what was behind that episode.
Yeah, I mean, back in 1993, I mean, it's going back some time now, I was Buforus press officer. And this is the days before email. So I had a letter from a chap, which we got quite a few, saying, would you like to be interested in you know, helping with a documentary? His name was Ray Santilli, lived in London. So I rang him up. And he said, you know, he's thinking about doing a sort of a general UFO documentary, could be for a help. And I said, yes, just depending on what your requirements were. And that's how it started. I had a few more conversations with him later, and he then said, well, I actually have film of the events at Roswell. And not only do I have that, I've actually got, you know, footage of one of the aliens being autopsied. Are you interested? So I said, yes, show us the film. And he said, yes, I can. No, I can't. Yes, I can. No, I can. This went on for about a year and a half. I met Ray briefly at a Bufora event in London. His offices were quite nearby to where we staged some of our meetings. Mm-hmm. Told me a story. And so in 1995, I received a copy of Roswell the movie on video for review purposes. And Ray Santilli had given me his business card. So I thought, well, if this chap still claims to have this film footage. So I literally just rang him out of the blue. And he said, yeah, I've still got it, Philip, but you don't believe me. I had told him to you know, go away at that point. So I said, look, I can't believe it unless you show me. So he said, right, make an appointment with my secretary and you know, and we'll show you it. So I did. So in the early part of 1995, my wife, Sue, and I drove to London, met him. He showed us the film, and I was also at that point Buforus conference organizer, and I'd already got a conference pretty much finished for August of 1995. And just off the top of my head, I said, you know, will you show it at the conference? And he, to my surprise, he said yes. And you know, the rest, as they say, is history. So it all started purely by chance, you know. And it was extremely controversial at the time, and it took me all this time to get to the bottom of it, but I did. But that's how it started.
Right. You're clearly hoping people will be so curious that they'll want to know your book to find out the answers. But,
well, I'll gladly tell them the answers. I mean, one of the reasons for asking Ray to show it at the conference was I knew that somehow it would get out into the public domain. I mean, we really, you know, we had a film, a few of people had seen it, so it wasn't just a letter or a rumour on the end of a telephone. There was a piece of film, or in fact there were several pieces. And my hope was that someone would come forward and say, you know, that's me, I'm one of the actors in it, you know, or I provided the props for it, it's a fake, or no, you know, that was my granddad and he told me it was real, or that's me, and, you know, I'm now 90 years old, but I did that back in my youth. But so that was one of the reasons for asking to show it at the conference. And in the early days, Santilli had no television lined up or anything like that. He was going to put it all on video and sell it, you know, just on video, nothing else. But eventually the television companies got involved and it was shown around the world, quite literally. It was a huge sensation. And but nothing happened. Nobody came forward. There was nobody came forward and said, it was me, I made it. You know, there was nobody came forward and said, it's real, that's me, that I'm in it, or me, it was my granddad and he told me on his deathbed. I mean, that just did not happen. So we looked at the film from what we could. I mean, Santilli was very cagey. He never gave us any film, physical film, bits of film to analyse. So we did the best with what we could. And, you know, some evidence seemed to support the film's authenticity while others seemed to detract from it. But there was no definitive proof one way or the other. And I remember, you know, I had a cordial lunch with Santilli in London one day. And I said, I will get to the bottom of it, Ray. And he just smiled and he said, that's fine, Philip. You know, and left it at that. So about a year or so, I think it was, after it was released, a group of special effects experts at a company called The Really Dangerous Company in America released a little document. They call it like the bloopers document. And it was little mistakes that they believe you could see in the film if you looked at it closely. Probably mistakes that only somebody from the special effects industry would notice. Anyway, I literally put the film on, sat there with this list and watched for what the pointers they were making, and lo and behold, you could see them. So I thought, we're onto something here. And slowly but surely, colleagues and I, Tim Matthews in the UK, Mark Center in the United States, and others, chipped away at it. And cutting a long story very short, in 2006, we'd exposed some of the film already. But then we had a lucky break, and a gentleman contacted us. We already had his first name, but we couldn't find him. And he was called Spiros Melaris, originally from Cyprus, but he lived down in London. And, you know, cutting a long story very short, he was the man who led the team that faked it. He had a small team which included a UK sculptor by the name of John Humphreys. He had other members of his family. And he made it, and he just gave it to Santilli as a job, and Santilli was then the marketing man behind it. And off he went on his merry way. He didn't make any money out of it at all. So, you know, that is it in a nutshell. There's a long story as to how he became involved and so on, but, you know, Santilli still denies it, but not only did I have spoken to Spiros, I've seen his documentary evidence, which is like, for example, his diaries of the time. He did a storyboard, because he didn't just make a film, he built a story around it as well. All his research files, faxes from Kodak, a whole host of other material. And I haven't seen everything he has, but I've seen enough. Like I said, we already had his first name, but we just didn't know who the man was. And he came out, you know, he came out of the woodwork, so to speak. And we finally put a nail in the coffin. You know, it is a complete scam made for money. Marketed by Ray Santilli and his business partner Gary Shewfield. So it's, you know, the book is my complete research dossier, if you like, how we tried to uncover or get to the bottom of the film. We didn't know what the bottom of it was, of course. We just tried our best, and we were evidence led. Wherever the evidence led us, that's where we followed. And you know, a lot of people say, "Well, I told you so, Philip." But yeah. It's easy just pointing your finger at something and saying, yeah, it's a fake or it's a hoax. Proving it is a different matter. It took a long time, but we got there.
Yes. I think for anyone who followed the UFO subject and ETs, they perhaps would be somewhat suspicious having seen the original video. But I think as people looked at it more closely, like the group of people you mentioned who found fault with it, I think it became reasonably apparent that there were things wrong with it. And then you had to think really that it was done that way to make money for someone, but you say that Ray Santilli didn't make anything out of it.
No, Ray Santilli made an awful lot of money.
The man who actually
made the film, Spiros Malalis, made no money from it at all. And when you view the film, there is nothing obvious in it that points to a fake. Like I said, the bloopers that the special effects experts are little indicators, but they are no means, you know, definitive proof that it's a fake. The little things that you have to watch very, very carefully, and it is evidence, but it wasn't sufficient evidence to say, yes, it's definitely a fake. There were alternative explanations to it. Mm. Bearing in mind, all they've got is a video film to work from. Similarly, colleagues and I showed the film to medical professionals around the world, a lot of whom were very impressed with it and said, yeah, it is an authentic medical procedure. It's done correctly. They're using the correct instruments that were used in 1947. There's nothing wrong there. All the artifacts you see in the room are all from that era. You know, there wasn't a digital watch, for example, on somebody's hand. So there was nothing one way or another that proved it to be a fake. Like I said, there was evidence that both supported the film's authenticity and detracted from it as well. So there was nothing positive one way or the other. You know, the only way to get to the bottom of it and prove it was to find those that were behind it. And you know, that's what we did. It took a long time, but we managed it eventually. And then look at their, you know, again, their stories weren't good enough. We had to look at the documentary evidence that Spiros Malalis has. And like I say, he's got a box full of it to prove, to back up what he's saying. And, you know, there is no question he was indeed the man that led the team that faked it.
It's interesting to hear some of your comments about the surgical procedures, because I recall seeing a video of the operation with someone actually commenting on how unprofessional a lot of that was.
Yeah, well, it just depended which TV program you watched. I mean, you know, I corresponded and liaised with a variety of medical professionals, a lot of whom were very impressed with it. Yeah, there were those that said, no, I'm not impressed. What you found was that there wasn't any one standard procedure for conducting such a thing. You know, there was the basics, and everybody else had their own little technique. What was sort of an underlying theme was that it wasn't necessarily an autopsy. It looked more of a dissection, which is completely different. An autopsy records things in a certain way, a certain manner, whereas a dissection, you literally just take it apart and worry about it later. But, you know, again, in the book we have comments from the medical profession from the UK, from the United States, from Norway, from Russia, from Italy, all over the place, a lot of whom were quite convinced that the procedure that was carried out was the genuine article. They weren't saying it was a real creature or it was from Mars or whatever, or anything like that, but the actual techniques that were used were correct, and, you know, we had to take their lead on that. So, you know, again, there wasn't anything that, when you looked at it from a medical point of view, there wasn't any one thing on there that would say, yeah, the film's a fake because they did something completely wrong. Quite the opposite, in fact.
Now, having found out that it was a sham, one of the worrying questions surely must have been, where was the body obtained from?
Well, it was a dummy.
A dummy, all right.
Yeah, I mean, it was a dummy made by a UK sculptor by the name of John Humphreys. John has on occasion worked in television and film. You know, his skills have overlapped into those fields. And, you know, he based the dummy on one of his own children. He made a mould and they cast the dummies out of that. As part of his training, he studied at the Royal Academy. He'd also studied anatomy. So he knew a good bit about that and how certain things worked and blood flow and this kind of thing. And Spiros Malalis, he had many strings to his bow. And one of his, you know, he was a stage magician. So he knew how to create illusions, if you like. And a lot of that is built into the film as well. Little things that perhaps aren't that obvious. But, for example, there's a telephone on the wall with a curly flex. I remember one chap, when he saw that, said it's a fake because they didn't have curly flexes in 1947. But when we checked, yes, they did. They just didn't come as standard. You had to order it as a special, and it cost you a little bit more. So, you know, but Spiros built little things like that into it, you know, that at first you'd think it was a fake, but then when you checked, you'd realise it wasn't. And these weren't, you know, accidents. They were built into the makeup of the fake, if you like, on purpose. And but yes, John Humphreys was the guy who made the dummies, and he's still, you know, he's an excellent sculptor in his own right, but he did those, and they were a very good job.
Yes, indeed. I think the face was particularly like some of the ETs have been described. So that was obviously purposefully done that way to help to give the illusion of it being an ET.
Yeah, I mean, they did their homework. There's slight differences because it also has six fingers on each hand and six toes on each foot. But again, these were little things they built in to make it, you know, not an identical alien, if you like. You know, they use a little bit of science fiction in that respect. But then, you know, you looked at cultures around the world, you know, a lot of cultures where their gods had six fingers and six toes, you know. And if we, yes. Someone of my age, I'm 52, I used to go back, we used to add up in 12s, you know, not 10, right. Not the metric system. So, you know, some things were done on purpose. There was a lot of planning done into went into it. And there were little accidents that happened as well that helped.
Now, just moving away from the sham, I guess in reality, where there have been crashes, such as at Roswell, the bodies have been taken off and subjected to examination. Have you any knowledge of those sort of things?
No, I mean, I have no more knowledge than anyone else. I mean, you know, I mean, I've spoken to many of the sort of main Roswell researchers. I've been to Roswell. I lectured there in 2007. And one of the things where, you know, people didn't necessarily dismiss the film straight away was that it was always rumoured that, you know, film and photographs were taken at Roswell at the time. If you believe in the MJ-12 documents, for example, it tells you in there that, you know, film was taken. And, it would have been quite ironic that, you know, a London businessman stumbled across it, but not impossible. And there were lots of coincidences and bits of luck that Ray Santilli had at that time, because people were saying, impossible to get secret film out of America, you know, which is what he claimed to have done, of course. And then, lo and behold, on a car boot sale in England, somebody bought some blank, what were, you know, supposedly blank videos, and took them home, put them in the machine, played them, and they were actually top secret training videos of the SAS. So how did they end up on a car boot sale in England, you know? Mistakes do happen. So so that was, a kind of a plus in Ray Santilli's favour, a very lucky one. But no, I mean, I've been to some of the sites in Roswell where the crashes have supposedly happened, and it was always rumoured that film was taken, but as yet, you know, none of that has surfaced. So we'll just wait and see.
Do you think there is any possibility that the Black Ops were behind this and allowed it to go ahead? Because you would have thought that if there was initially some feeling that it was a genuine ET, the authorities would have taken it.
Well, I think we put too much, you know, emphasis on what supposedly the authorities can and can't do. That was one of the arguments about, you know, the alien autopsy film. Had it been real, then, you know, the whoever the authorities are would have come and taken it. But the cat was already out of the bag. It was too late. The story was around the world. It went out in the newspapers, went on the wires, and was around the world. So it was too late, you know, and stills were available here, there, and everywhere. You know, I had stills, I had some film. You know, in today's age, by the time it came out, you know, the internet had started. This was the early days of the internet, 1995, and email, which makes things even more difficult to control. So even had it been the genuine article, you know, there was no way to stop it. It took on a life of its own almost, and it snowballed. And so, no, I don't think the authorities had anything to do with it or could control it. and would have even if it had been the genuine article, there's nothing they could do about it, nothing whatsoever at all.
Hmm. Now, I've already said that it took you 14 years to get to the bottom of this. What in particular made it so difficult for you to do that? I mean, did people block you off, or what was the problem?
No, there was no people blocking us off. It was just a slow process. I mean, you know, trying to find it was more difficult than a needle in a haystack, quite literally. But a lot of it depended on trying to keep the film in the public eye. I always had the hope, and nothing more than that, but if I could keep the film somehow in the public domain, that whoever was behind it would eventually be found. I didn't quite know how, didn't quite know why, but I believed that. And that did happen. That's exactly how it did happen. And in the early days, I got some criticism for keeping it in the public eye. But that was always my reason for doing so. Out of the blue, for example, I had an email from a chap saying, I know a bit more about this film, and gave me his phone number, and I rang him. And he told me about a piece of film that he'd been shown in a Milton Keynes office. And it was called The Tent Footage. It's a piece of the whole thing that's never been shown on television, which I have. And that led us to a company called AK Music. And eventually we tracked them down, one of the owners down. And it was them that started the ball rolling. Basic scenario is, they used to have little brainstorming sessions, and they worked with Ray Santilli. They didn't work for him, but they worked with him. Mm-hmm. He was there one day, and somebody had a book on Roswell, and somebody said, you know, wouldn't it be great if we had some Roswell footage? We could make some money out of that. Keith Bateman, was one of the owners of AK Music. They used to make, believe it or not, karaoke videos. So he went off to a barn in Bedfordshire and made this piece of tent footage. It lasts for about 6 minutes. It's dark. It's a creature on a slab covered with a cloth. Two surgeons removing some kind of fleshy material. And that's basically all it is. They then took that to Ray Santilli. And said, what do you think? And he said, no, it's rubbish. Go away and get me a quote to make some better stuff. Well, they came back with a quote which was too expensive as far as Santilli was concerned. But nonetheless, you know, the idea had been hatched. Santilli hung on to this piece of film called The Tent Footage, invented a story about buying some film from a mysterious cameraman in 1993 in America, and he used that film as bait. It was the first film he showed me. Excuse me, it was the first film he showed to Spiros Malaris. And so had it not been for Keith Bateman, none of this would have happened in the first place. But Keith was the first one to come out, and we proved part of it was a fake. But again, you know, Santilli was very clever, and he said, oh, I'd already dismissed that piece of film. And then he invented a cock and bull story to try and cover it up. So it was just a question of being persistent, you know, and being patient and carrying on. And it went on from there, of course. And eventually, you know, Spiros came out of the woodwork. And the way we got into Spiros was UFO magazine. It was still going then. Graham was still alive, and I did an article on the alien autopsy, which was on the front cover.
Oh yeah.
And then a chap contacted me and said, I didn't know anyone was interested in this. And I won't give his name because I haven't got permission. But we eventually met this chap, and he said, well, I'll tell you what. He says, my friend made the dummies for it.
Wow.
And he wouldn't give us his name to begin with, but he gave us enough hints to try and figure out who he was. But we put this chap in touch with TV producer Bob Kiviat in America, and although Bob signed a confidentiality agreement, he wouldn't tell us the name, but he got the guy who made the dummies. And eventually I did. I used the little tidbits of information I'd got. And found out who he was. And as I've said, he was called John Humphreys. John talked about Spiros. He wouldn't give us a second name. And one of the things he said was, you need to speak to Spiros, but he wouldn't divulge any other names. So that gave us a bit more information. We got the man who actually made the dummies. We got a first name of Spiros. And then the Ant and Dec film came out in 2006. with a change of story by Santilli. Santilli and Shufield are executive producers of it. And there was some kind of disagreement with Spiros and Santilli and Shufield. He hadn't had a lot to do with them down the years, but there was some disagreement. And Spiros was then looking for the best way to go public. He found our details, contacted us, and spilled the beans. And in 2007, we hosted a conference in the UK, all based around Roswell, and Spiros made the one and only public appearance so far and told the story to the audience. And, you know, again, the cat was out of the bag. So, it was just being persistent, trying to keep it in the public eye, and you know, eventually we got there. And I didn't think it'd take that long, but, you know, I was persistent nonetheless.
Right, yes. I think at this stage it might be a good idea if you tell our listeners how they can subscribe to the magazine and where they can read perhaps a review of your book and buy it.
Yeah, I mean the magazine, if you don't want to subscribe, you know, in the UK you can buy it in most W.H. Smith stores. It's in a lot of little independent ones as well. And like I said, overseas you'll find it in Barnes & Noble and Borders. Alternatively, if you want to subscribe, which is the cheaper option, and just go online, it's www.healingsofatlantis.com. And both books and magazines are all at the same place. It's all the same company. So they're all there. And we've got a nice selection of other books as well, not just mine, but others. But you can subscribe from anywhere in the world, you know, to the magazine. And like I say, it's a lot cheaper to do it that way. And you can buy the books there as well.
Oh, that's great. Okay. I'd like to move on now, really, to more current things. What are your views about disclosure? Do you think that something might happen in the next few months?
Not at all. I don't expect anything at all to happen. When you've been involved in ufology for as long as I have, and it's, you know, 30-plus years now, the idea of disclosure kind of goes round in circles. You know, I don't know, every few years or every 5 years or every 10 years or something like that, for whatever reason, it builds up and people seem to think that there's going to be some big, you know, announcement or, you know, the smoking gun is going to appear and it doesn't happen, you know. So today's disclosure movement, I think, is just the modern day equivalent of that. You know, today we've got, you know, the internet and things of that nature to help spread the word. And we've got people who are prepared to put on events at the press club in the States and various other conferences and so on. But I'm pretty confident that, you know, nothing will happen. It's just the latest evolution of this particular idea. I hope I'm wrong. You know, I hope somebody proves me wrong, but I honestly don't expect anything to happen. What will happen, you know, and again, people can check this, and if, you know, the listeners can check to see if I'm right or not. You know, excuses will come out as to why it didn't happen. You know, Obama will have pulled it, or the, you know, Black Ops will have pulled it, or the CIA, or you know, or MJ-12, or some. They were almost there, and it got scuppered at the last minute, but it won't happen. You know, and we shall see.
Well, indeed, yes. I was going to ask you, don't you sort of sense at the moment, though, that there seems to be a lot more information suddenly coming out about UFOs? For example, you mentioned earlier about these commanders of these nuclear bases. I think there was about half a dozen of them, all had experiences with UFO craft disabling the nuclear warheads. I found that quite surprising that information should be allowed to come out. It rather suggests...
Well, I mean, they're all out in the public domain anyway. I mean, they're all retired. I mean,
yes.
A lot of what they were saying is nothing new. I mean, for example, there's Colonel Holt there.
Yes.
Colonel Holt's spoken about this on many different occasions. The only thing is that they've put all these people together in one place and have got themselves organised. And it follows on from, you know, previous people at the press club. What was it, a couple of years back, that they had, you know, pilots and senior military officials do the same thing at the press club. All the instances that these gentlemen talked about were all well known. They were all in the public domain. But, you know, they got them organised and got them all there. It was all done professionally. So in that respect, it's nothing new. It's just new in the way it's being presented, you know, officially by a body who's organised it at the press club, whereas before you may get, you know, Colonel Holt spoken in public before and so on. So I'm sorry, but it's nothing new. It's just presented in a new way.
Okay. Do you think something might finally come of the setup that Stephen Greer runs? Because I think it was just before the end of last year, he was preparing to release a lot of the witnesses' information about any association with UFOs, and there were a lot there to do with the military or the Air Force, that type of thing. And he was actually indicating that if Obama didn't make the announcement, that he would go ahead himself. Now, nothing's happened, but you get the feeling sooner or later that something will. So what do you think of Stephen Greer's position in this?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I've never met Stephen Greer. I've spoken to him, I think, once on the telephone, but I've never met him. And don't know that much about him, to be brutally honest. But I think any UFO researcher who's been involved in the subject for a long time will, you know, sooner or later come across, you know, military personnel who have a story to tell. I mean, I've done it myself. Conference we held a couple of years back, we had a wing commander, MBE, speak at the conference and tell us about six UFOs he tracked on a number of radar stations across mainland UK. Fascinating story, but, you know, nothing more than that, you know. And so even if, you know, somebody like Stephen Greer, all you can do, I mean, a lot of people can do it if you've got the time, the effort and the money to do it. You can collect people like Wing Commander Alan Turner, he was, and others, and put them in a group, and they tell their stories. And, you know, that'll be the same with Stephen Greer or anyone who wants to do that. But does it mean anything different? Again, I'm not sure it does. It's just a collection of similar types of witnesses lumped together. For example, police detective Gary Heseltine runs his own website, and on there is all police officer sightings, both police officers who are on duty or retired or you know, on duty at the time. So, you know, again, I've met police officers who have had UFO sightings, but Gary, because he's a serving police officer himself, has kept them all in one place. And it's the same with military witnesses. I don't think it necessarily proves anything at all, to be perfectly honest. It's fascinating, absolutely fascinating, but nothing more than that.
Okay. What do you personally think of the origin of UFOs? Where do you think they come from?
I'm one of those who still sits on the fence. I honestly don't know. I can be fairly sceptical at times. If you've been involved in a long time, I think that's just a byproduct of UFO investigation. I think the role that I see as a UFO researcher and investigator is to document this material, and hopefully, at some point, somebody will be able to make a bit more sense of it. I remember, again, at a Bufora event I organised some years back, and we had Whitley Strieber come lecture for us for the first time in the UK. And what Whitley said towards the end of his presentation, which was excellent, and it stuck with me ever since, was that we're now asking better questions about the subject. In other words, we don't have, you know, enough knowledge. We're now learning to ask better questions. And I think that's the same today, you know. And things like the press club event and you know, witnesses coming forward of a whole variety of different calibres helps. It adds more information to the puzzle, and it perhaps helps us formulate better questions. In other words, we're trying to learn more. So I think the jury's still out. And it's one of the things that keeps me going, of course. If I hand on heart believe that UFOs were X, Y, or Z, well, that would be time for me to hang up me cap, if you like, and call it a day. But I don't, so I shall continue.
Right. There are Oh, there have been over many years lots of stories about the small bug-eyed aliens with the thin bodies, long arms, called the Greys, who it is alleged have bases on the Earth. Have you come across any witnesses or evidence of that type of thing?
I've not come across any bases as such, but one of my earlier books was called Without Consent, and co-authored by a colleague of mine by the name of Carl Nagatis. And it's all about, in that particular, you know, field of research, we looked at a lot of missing time and abduction accounts from the UK, and the UK only. And yes, the small grey creatures were reported. I mean, an incident just reported to us last week from the Barnsley area. There is a lady that claims to have encountered the small grey creatures, and a colleague of mine is dealing with that as we speak. But as for underground bases, you know, I've never crossed that bridge, never come across any information that would support that particular theory or hypothesis. But entity sightings, encounters, call them what you will, yes, but nothing more than that.
Right. What do you think about the evidence, or seemingly it is evidence, that during the years of World War II, that the Germans had already developed a saucer-type craft?
Well, I've looked at some of that, and a colleague of mine who again worked on the alien autopsy with me, called Tim Matthews, did a lot of work on so-called man-made UFOs, and I don't think there's a lot of evidence to support the fact that the Nazis developed a flying saucer. I think there's certainly drawings, but I don't think there's anything that would suggest that they actually got one off the ground, that they actually built one. And you have to remember, you know, at the end of the war, the various Allies got all the German technology. I mean, it was the, you know, Wernher von Braun who put man on the moon.
Yes.
You know, so they got all the technology. And if you look at what came out of that, there was nothing that would support the fact that, you know, saucers were built by the Nazis. I mean, the nearest the Americans came was the Canadian built Avro car, and you know, it couldn't get 8 feet off the ground. It was a complete disaster. But you know, the German scientists were certainly inventive, and it would not have surprised me if you know, they didn't get drawings well, they did have drawings, but maybe even some, you know, some models. But I don't think it ever got beyond that at all. I mean, they you know, some of the experiments that they conducted would never have surprised me, but I doubt it. I really doubt it. But again, you know, we still find out more about what did and didn't happen during the war. And who knows, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think they got that far, to be honest.
I know you obviously can't rely on bits of old film that are put together, but something that is in my memory about that particular claim is that they showed some old black and white film in which they alleged that this craft had been built by the Germans, and it looked very similar to the bell-shaped craft that was associated with George Adamski, you know, the scout craft. And I thought that was rather remarkable.
It's a piece of film I've not seen, I'm not aware of. I'm not aware of anything concrete that would support the fact that the Germans built flying saucers that actually worked. You know, all the German energy was, if you think about it from a military point of view, there was no point in it. It doesn't make any sense. They wanted to, you know, bomb the living daylights out of people, namely us. And that's where their energies were put in, and those were the V1, the V2, and of course the V3 as well. That was even bigger and more accurate. And of course, they were trying to make the atomic bomb. So, like I say, it wouldn't have surprised me if they perhaps hadn't got to the prototype stage of something, but, you know, the Allies would have got that information after the war, and they simply didn't, you know. Rockets were the things the Germans were into, and it was that technology that eventually put the Russians into space and, of course, put the man on the moon.
Yes, absolutely.
But nothing else, I'm afraid.
Well, you may not believe it, Philip, but we've just about come to the end of the programme. It's been flying along there. Very interesting to talk to you. I've got a couple of minutes left in which I will announce my guests for next week. But I must thank you very much for coming on to the programme. And our listeners may not necessarily be aware of it, but you did accept my invitation at relatively short notice, for which I'm very grateful.
No, it's my pleasure, and I hope your listeners will take a look at UFO Matrix. You know, it's an excellent publication, and I'm not biased, honest. And, you know, I'll be interested to hear from them, you know, and, you know, hopefully they'll perhaps consider a subscription as well. After all, Christmas is coming.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you very much, Philip. For our listeners, I'll mention that next week I have Anne Eller as my guest. She was Dr. J. Allen Hynek's personal assistant during the last year of his life, and he was considered the father of UFO research. And she wants to tell of that experience and also about her visitation from other dimensional ET female beings. She said it was an experience that lasted 2 days, and she was left with a message to tell the world, which no doubt we will hear. So thank you for being with me today. I do hope you can make it next week. God bless you all. Thank you very much.